I was managing my assets late one night when my eyes beheld a dreadful sight. The economy began to destabilize, and suddenly, to my surprise,
the market crashed.
It was a monster crash.
A monster crash.
No one could borrow cash.
The market crashed.
It collapsed in a flash.
The market crashed.
Holy Hannah, the wheels are coming off the gilded wagon of capitalism. This is Radio Eagleshawk, and I'm at least one Alex Smith, maybe two. Part of me is excited that the zombie system killing the planet has cracked open. My other side is fearful. I like peaceful streets and grocery stores with food in them. Damn it, I'm cheering and weeping for both sides.
From the corner office and executive suite to the trading floor and throughout Wall Street, everybody came from their humble abodes to salvage what they could while the system implodes.
The market crashed.
It was a monster crash.
A monster crash.
Over the last 3 years of weekly podcasts and radio broadcasts, I've had the good fortune to interview top experts. Like many of you, I've nervously scanned both the bad economic prospects and the worst threats of climate change. Well, let's have a little chat. After last week's program, where I realized the climate has already tipped, I briefly considered ending Radio EcoShock. Part of my mission was to save the climate, to stop the change. Now, with the latest science in, I don't think that is possible. We have inadvertently tipped a switch that will end up, as James Hansen says, with a different planet. Just with the greenhouse gas emissions already released and committed by our dependence on coal and oil, the irreversible melting of the polar ice has begun, along with the world's glaciers. It's just a matter of how fast, how bad, and can we adapt. In this time together, I'll give you some of my best guesses and my own puny plans and chatter from the net.
Not even acknowledging what I would say the majority of smart economists are saying, which is that the United States banking system is insolvent.
Angry voices and marching feet. The last thing a government facing a financial crisis wants to have to deal with.
Is it coincidence that the financial world has collapsed just as we learn our climate fate? I don't think so. The same people who looted our pension funds and banks were allied with the fossil fuel and automotive lobbies that quashed the early warnings on climate? Even deeper, 3 out of 4 Americans now know how serious climate is. They've seen it in the fires, the floods, the droughts, the storms. A poll done by Rasmussen Reports found that 23% of Americans, 1 in 4, say it is somewhat likely that global warming will destroy human civilization within the next century. So we know. In the early arrival of the birds, the strange weather, we know and we have lost confidence in both the system and ourselves. This is no return to normal. There is only adaptation to constant change. You and I need to prepare for turbulent times on 2 different but related paths. We hope to stay fed in our homes in the short term. Yet some of us may have to move as climate migrants in the coming decade or two. We'll call it the 3-month strategy and the 3-year plan. That is coming up along with another installment of my audio blog on long-term food storage, where Alex finds out that not everything goes as expected.
And it means doing something very, very radical, admitting total failure.
Basic to all this is the idea that you need to move from being an information consumer, a witness to tragic times, as exciting as they are, to become an actor in your own life and community. I know how easy it is to sit spellbound at the screen watching unheard-of events unfold, but one of the most astounding results will be people thrown awake from the former system. Just as Soviet communism fell, we are now engaged in a similar disruption, the fall of greed is good capitalism. The replacement could be better or worse, and that is where you come in. Whether you build a better world or just choose to survive in a sustainable way, it is time to get engaged, don't you think? The corporate system has always demanded most of our life energy. People work crazy hours, sometimes at two or three jobs, just to get all the symbols of wealth we were promised. Hardly an idle hour was left, and those were filled with mindless entertainment for our worn-out brains and bodies. Now the system is letting us go. By the millions. Even the media is breaking apart. We are back on our own to do as we will. I challenge myself to learn and act for survival while building sustainable community around me. You too. When it comes to the economy, the Gilded Age has passed. Even mass media admits the world's banking system is insolvent, beyond the resources of any government. Like the airliner hitting the birds, pilot Obama is trying to ditch in the Hudson River with the minimum loss of lives. In my opinion, he's chosen the wrong people to do it. Most of the financial advisors are coming from the same Wall Street crowd who screwed the system. Tim Geithner was the head of the New York Federal Reserve, one of the chief enablers of the subprime mess and the off-book gambling by banks. Who did Obama pick to oversee the restructuring of the American auto industry? Another Wall Street honcho, Steve Rattner, the co-founder of Quadrangle Group, one of the leveraged buyout companies who did so much damage to corporate debt loads. Oh yeah, Rattner just happens to be a top Democratic Party fundraiser as well. Are there no experts outside Wall Street and outside the Democratic insiders?
Are these the words of the all-powerful boards and syndicates of the earth?
The latest plan is to give hedge funds, those jackals, $1 trillion of taxpayers' money to buy out worthless paper assets from the banks. Well, that's going to work. That after the administration pulled its previous bank rescue plan at the last moment. It seems inevitable that the big American banks like Citi and Bank of America will be nationalized, meaning those multi-trillion-dollar holes of bad debt and imaginary money will all be laid on the shoulders of the taxpayer. It's a last-ditch desperate gamble. I like my regular three meals a day. I like finding supplies at the store when I want them. My old life was pretty good. So part of me hopes that Obama's magic can stall off the crash as long as he can. Every day is a good day, but in my opinion, no, we can't. The old economy was a planet killer, based on greed and lies, and it is failing as we speak. Maybe the illusion will continue for a year or two, but the patient has already passed on. That means big changes for you and I, whether we like it or not, and mostly, we won't.
There was a sea change in the financial system from which we have not recovered.
There may be an upside. Those millions of unemployed and millions soon to be homeless will be free to get active in the community and in the streets. That could end up with a demand for fascism or a great leader syndrome, but there's an equal chance that the big systems will crash, revealing more local organization and some hope. Already we are seeing giant corporations like General Motors in their death throes along with the hated Hummer. We are also seeing national governments dissolve, unable to form a government in Iceland, Israel, Latvia, the Ukraine, and possibly even in Britain. Of course, such national chaos and weakness is common in many developing countries, which may not develop so much after all. There's a new thing I'm trying to emphasize here. The bigger they come, the harder they fall. Municipal governments, weak and in debt as they are, may become much more important in your life and your life support systems. And new micro-networks will spring up based on faith or community or other values and causes, but they will come together. People will come together.
The financial crisis became so bad. You know, some of the news during some of the weekends were absolutely terrifying. That around the world, people just said something terrible may be happening.
It's interesting to recognize the ladder of homelessness that's now coming about. People try and sell to buy lower-cost housing, but no one can get financing. Many lose their homes and go to renting. If key jobs are lost, the next step can be a travel trailer or an old gas-guzzling motorhome parked in an RV park or even on a side road. The RV parks are already filling up their monthly rental spaces right now. Then, it's a tent. Even before this crash, a series of tent cities appeared in America. For example, around the Seattle area, after a period of police harassment, there is now a rotating system of tent cities. The tenters get a field or a big churchyard for 3 months in one area and then have to move to another part of the region, so I'm told. Of course, this makes education for the kids nearly impossible. Church groups and other community organizations are arranging gardening spots and daily food runs for these homeless people, some of whom were recently middle class. I expect we'll see more of that. For what it's worth, I think your family should have a tent and the equipment to cook there in case of any emergency, whether it's financial, climatic, or a natural earthquake. Add that to your planning list, a tent, sleeping bags, a tarp, metal cookware.
How can we know the time of crisis has arrived? Is the panic heart beating? Or is it only mine?
Well, this is not the future my mother warned me about.
Most of us with an income face a different challenge. Should we stay where we are or prepare to move soon? It's a fight or flight kind of thing. I found a good chain of discussion under the title Survival Retreat versus Neighborhood Survival by Dr. Richard. It appeared on theoildrum.com, originating at Virginia Preppers Network. blogspot.com. That's virginiapreppersnetwork.blogspot.com on February 11, 2009. Richard writes, and I quote, "There are four major flaws in the survival retreat separate from your home concept. One, there are significant liabilities and social problems with communal retreats where one does not own the property. You are vulnerable to the actions of the others, particularly the property owner. Two, property left unattended at retreats is vulnerable to theft and vandalism. This is going to be a growing problem as the economic depression gets worse, especially if we have economic collapse. Three, getting to the retreat would be problematic in the event that it is actually needed, particularly in martial law scenarios where the military and law enforcement block traffic at key intersections or in cases where there are fuel shortages. Think Katrina, I add. Four, relatively undeveloped retreats with a trailer and undeveloped land may not be sufficiently developed for long-term survival and offer insufficient space for storage of the various preps and other items you may need. Many of these items would likely be at your day-to-day residence, and you cannot assume that you can transport everything at the last minute. My view, says Richard, is that survival retreats only work if you live there full time. Furthermore, although remote locations are further removed from the masses, they are also further removed from jobs, markets, customers, hospitals, and many other useful infrastructure, and will be harder pressed to gather a sufficiently large group to cover all of the tasks needed in a true long-term survival scenario." That's an end of quote from Dr. Richard at virginiapreppersnetwork.blogspot.com. I agree with him, basically. In my own case, there is no hope of selling off this condo, no buyers and no money. So we have taken a two-tracked approach here. First of all, we are now homesteading where we live, right in the city. I'll talk about that. We also had the foresight a few years ago to buy a trailer in a small village in the mountains. We do have a place to run, but I can tell you from personal experience of living on the land, without electricity for about 10 years, older people are not likely to be able to make that change suddenly. It takes years of preparation, learning, and setup to provide most of your own basics from food to heat. I'm hoping we don't have to fly away. Homesteading in the city has several components. First, I suggest you need to switch from fast foods to self-cooked meals coming from bulk food store and do it right now. In just a few minutes, I'll tell you exactly how I've created food insurance for our family. Second, you need to consider local food supplies and how they function. After decades of flying in winter fruit from South America, many of us are not prepared for the natural economy, which only provides in the appropriate season. I'm going to call that the pulse economy. It's the way people have lived for thousands of years. The third step is community organizing right down to your neighbors. That's hard, as we've all been trained to individuate and not communicate. Many of us hardly know our neighbors, but we will need them in the times to come. I won't be discussing that much in this program. We'll save it for another time. Now it is time for my audio blog on preparing food to survive. If you've listened to Radio EcoShock, you will know there are tremendous stresses developing in our food system. Just this week, for example, the state of California, which provides the bulk of fruits and nuts and vegetables, announced there is zero water allowance for the most productive area in the Central Valley. The Central Valley Water Project, which irrigates those lands, simply has no water for sale this year due to the continuing drought brought on by a climate shift. Another state-run water system has 15% of its normal water supply. Many thousands of acres will not be planted, and others will not provide the food we normally expect. That's just one of a long list of crop problems, many caused by climate change, that will make food more expensive and harder to get. Do not fool yourself. The full shelves you see in the supermarket are not backed by massive warehouses. The food system shifted to just-in-time delivery, where trucks arrive directly from California, Mexico, or Florida. Where the United States and Canada used to store more than a year's worth of grains, experts like Lester Brown now warn that the world food storage has fallen below 2 months' worth. That's serious. Here's a record of what I've been doing to protect my family.
You're in a big city now that won't stop growing yet. The sun is going down smoking a flaming testament. Something has been broken and it feels permanent. A little seabird flying knows where he wants to go. Yes, I ought to pack my stuff and do the thing I know. I turn around and head on back along the old seawall. I felt something given crack and now I'm sorry.
It's a bit of beachcombing with Mark Knopfler and Emmy Lou Harris. This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
You should by now have built up an emergency reserve of tinned food or other foods that don't go off quickly and that can be eaten cold.
The news about food production is terrible and will only get worse. Expect grocery store prices to rise because that's the last thing the financial oligarchy can count on you to buy. They need to make money. Food is not an option. Regular listeners will know I've been preparing a food insurance stash for my family, including four adults, two brothers-in-law, and one good-as-family friend, for a total of seven people. Most of the others are busy or in denial. They wonder if I'm crazy. They're prepared to watch me do the work and pay for it all. I'm officially classified as poor, so that adds to the challenge. If I can do it, you can do it. I started off with a three-month plan, not knowing when a crisis might develop. In a few months or 3 years from now, I decided to begin with long-term storage. Of course, that was after a period of doubling up on regular purchases. Living in earthquake country, we already had a decently stocked pantry, plus 5 gallon jugs of water. We've had those for several years now. But now I want to feel confidence we'll be able to eat for at least 3 months. That would give us time to adapt and decide what to do next. At this point, we can't afford a couple of $1,000s for commercially prepared long-term food packages. Our minimal budget means it will take several months just to get these basics. Here's how it's gone so far. To keep it simple for my simple brain, I assigned one food type per month. December was National Grain Month for our household, January for rice, February beans. Properly packaged raw wheat, known as hard red wheat berries, can last for 15 years or more. I headed out to a winemaking brew-it-yourself shop to buy 10 5-gallon pails with tight-fitting rubber-sealed lids. These are food-grade plastic, so I expect no nasty chemicals. A local supermarket bakery also gave me another 5 smaller buckets, the 4-gallon size. On the net, I found a place to order 2 specialty items, Mylar bags and oxygen depleters. To fill 5-gallon buckets, you want the 20-inch by 30-inch barrier bags. 24 of them cost $20.90. You can store food in buckets without these bags, but eventually oxygen gets into the food. Oxygen may cause discoloration and eventually deterioration of your food. For example, rice without a Mylar barrier bag will be slightly off color but still edible if stored cool and dry after 5 years. With the bag and a couple of small packets called oxygen depleters, the rice should last at least 10 years. We don't know when the big need will come. Oxygen absorbers are harmless mixes of iron and salt in a packet that looks like a sugar packet from your restaurant. I got a large bag of them, likely 100 or more, of the 750cc size, for $17.95. That was mail order, too. That will do most of your storage needs. One tip, before you cut open the plastic packaging for these things, be sure and have an airtight quart sealer jar or two handy. These babies start grabbing oxygen as soon as you open the packaging. They get hot if you just leave them around, and then weaker, on to useless. Stuff them all in a sealer jar or two right away. You will hear the lids pop down tight within a couple of minutes. Then take out the two or three packets you will need for every big bucket. National Wheat Month did not go as planned. I wanted a mix of the more expensive organic hard red wheat and some cheaper wheat as well. Note, it doesn't matter whether it is hard red winter wheat or hard red spring, they both make good bread. You can get the good organic stuff from any food co-op with an advance order. It's not cheap, though, at $3.33 a kilo in Canada in early 2009. A 20-kilo bag, which fills a 5-gallon bucket, can cost up to $66. I found it at $52 at a granary out of town, but I could only afford to buy 3 big bags, or 60 kilos. That's just over $150, big money for me. That was it for the month, pretty well. But that's month's worth of top-quality bread, at a time when good bread is already over $4 here in the supermarkets. The price of wheat will only go up for a lot of reasons. My fallback was to find some number 3 grade hard red wheat. That's the stuff used for animal feed. After many inquiries to both bakeries and to a grain expert here in town, all agreed that anyone can make decent bread out of so-called animal feed. The only difference is the number 3 grade missed the last stage of cleaning. You may need to use a sieve or otherwise clean it out before using it. And you may need to add some wheat gluten to get the best rising qualities when baking. I ordered 2 pounds of gluten from the local food co-op for $14, and that should make hundreds of loaves of bread. You can make your own gluten. There's a YouTube on video showing how. Now the mystery. Nobody in this city of grain shipping could find any animal wheat feed. I wanted 3 25-kilo bags, which would have cost only $22 a bag. The local co-op tried and failed. I phoned the grain traders. They couldn't explain it. I presume the farmers ordered their wheat ahead, but so far, no one can tell me why this very basic wheat item has completely disappeared in our region. If any of our listeners know, do tell. Write me radio@ecoshock.org. Bottom line, I don't have the amount of wheat I want yet. I may have to wait until the winter wheat harvest comes in. Having raw wheat without a mill is useless, yet the best grain mills are mucho dollars, as much as $500 up to $700. As the financial markets crashed further, I wanted a backup which could feed us, so I ordered the cheapo Back to Basics grain mill for $75 from an American online source. It arrived 2 weeks later. This little hand grinder attaches to your countertop with a clamp. The hopper is small, you'd have to keep feeding it, and it takes some muscle power to get flour, but it does produce flour and can grind other products as well. As the depression deepens, I am committing to baking bread for our family, likely daily. I'll need a grain mill I can stand to work with. I have ordered a Wonder Mill. It's an electric model which claims to produce 100 pounds of flour an hour. It costs $325 here in Canada, big money for me. I'll pick it up to save on delivery costs. If the electric grid goes down, I'll still have the Back to Basics model. The Wonder Mill is the replacement for the former Whisper Mill, which apparently went out of business. It's a countertop model and supposedly quieter than older designs. However, let's face it, all these electric mills are very noisy, but you only need to run them for a few minutes for a week's supply of flour. I might add that fresh flour from wheat berries contains a lot of extra healthy nutrients that do not survive in the store-bought bread processed and shipped to you. You get special nutrition from home-grown, homemade bread. So much for Wheat Month. On to Rice January. This turned out to be much easier once I'd checked out about 8 different stores for the best prices on large 18-kilo or nearly 40-pound bags of rice. Keep in mind with rice, if the worst comes, you don't even have to cook it to eat it. Put rice in a pot with water for at least 6 hours, and you can eat it without cooking. That is what makes rice the queen of survival foods. One local low-cost supermarket had a loss leader on rice, 18 kilos of name-brand Thai rice at $22.75 a bag. I bought 6 bags, which filled 6 5-gallon buckets. Now we have about 240 pounds of rice. Later that same week, I saw exactly the same rice priced at $38 in another branch of the same corporation. You must hunt like a hunting dog to find the good price and be prepared to swoop in and get it. With rice and wheat installed in buckets, sealed up in Mylar, it became Bean February. There are so many different kinds of beans to choose from, and you need beans to add necessary proteins and other goodies to your rice. Online research showed me that black beans are particularly healthy. I bought 2 10-kilogram bags of black beans, leading to 2 5-gallon buckets worth. It was $26 a bag. Beans are fairly cheap. I also got another 10-kilo bags of kidney beans and 10 kilos of garbanzo beans, also known as chickpeas, and 20 kilos of green lentils, perhaps a little over the top on the lentils. Lentils are small but heavy. 10 kilos fills only a 4-gallon bucket. It's best to find the right size bucket, as you want as little as air as possible on the top. Air contains the unwanted oxygen that will eventually spoil your food. I will also be using a pressure cooker to get pre-cooked beans into glass sealing jars. If the power goes out for a while, I can add these to my uncooked rice and will survive. Coming up in March, National Condiment Month. We still don't have all the spices, sugar, salt, baking powder, vinegar, and other dried veggies that can turn survival food into really tasty meals. We'll get that in March, now that the basics are here. To store these buckets, I built a simple wood rack 8 feet long, 2 feet wide. The two shelves are just pieces of half-inch plywood cut in at the lumber store. The supports are made from the cheapest 2x4 stud materials. Total cost, including 8 leg screws and some 3-inch Ardox nails, $46. Part of the idea, and I may be a fanatic about this, is to avoid stacking buckets on top of one another. Your insurance comes from maintaining the air seal. If you put a heavy bucket on the lid below, it may press down in the center and weaken the seal at the edges of the bucket below. This two-shelf support system holds 3 levels of buckets, 2 across, plenty to feed a family for up to a year. After March, I'll relax a bit on the food front, knowing we aren't going to starve. We'll start adding more canned food in April and May. Then in June, the real canning season begins with the berries. We hope to can a lot of vegetables as they come in later to 1 liter and 1 quart sealer jars. For more on that, listen to my explanation of living with the Pulse economy.
I want to see you in the sun.
Overall, I do feel more relaxed, even as the economic and climate news gets worse. At least we'll have some time to figure out our other options, and we have already saved a ton of money by buying in bulk. I doubt we'll ever see food prices so low again. I'm also pleased to tell you this approach to handling high food prices is catching on. Various American newspapers have reported housewives who are using the pantry as their personal store rather than going out and buying those ridiculously priced little packages, not to mention the horrible fast foods that drain out our pocketbooks. And I can tell you also from doing this, it's taken me 3 or 4 months to get a basic food supply in. So if you think that you're going to just go out at the last minute and grab some big bags of food, forget it. Those will all be cleaned off the shelves. And when I checked in these various places, they didn't have more in the storage room. It's a just-in-time food delivery service. So that puts us kind of at a risk, and I suggest you go out and get some now while the food is available. Last week, I ran into another local producer, radio producer, who lives in a semi-rural area close to our city. He said his family were so enthused by suggestions on this program, they talked to neighbors about it. Beyond the neighbors, they also had a network of families looking after developmentally challenged kids, the last people who should suffer if the supermarket shelves are suddenly emptied in a panic, or if food inflation becomes punitive. The result was an instant food co-op. 10 families agreed to pool $1,000 each to make a big bulk order. A local supermarket chain offered them food at cost, plus a tiny percent markup just for the handling. Another 40 individuals and families have expressed interest in buying in. The group has arranged storage spots for those without any cupboard space, and the whole thing has just taken off. That's just another example of the micro-networks of people I expect to spring up during this new depression, people who will work together rather than burrowing behind hidden walls with guns. Not that there's anything wrong with that. Who knows the future? I'm Alex Smith, and I don't, but I do feel better having food insurance, just as we have health insurance and car insurance. Broadcast on 16 stations in Canada and the United States. Going out over the world by satellite and cable, podcast and downloads, you've got Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith. Get tons of free MP3 downloads from our site at ecoshock.org. ECO, shock like an electric shock. It's radioactive.
Greensumers can enjoy organic apples from New Zealand, organic oranges from Israel, organic flowers from Senegal, and organic cherries from Chile, all in the dead of winter. Who needs the Kyoto Protocol when we can shop against climate change?
I could spend a whole program on the ways you can economize and do without in the coming depression. We'll do that soon. In this program, we'll also touch on Plan B. You either decide to get out of Dodge, as they say, or are forced from your home by conditions beyond your control. Just wrapping up the homesteading at home idea, you also need to look around and see what natural food may be available. For example, we do have a salmon-bearing stream within walking distance of our place, believe it or not, and I suppose it would be possible to hunt for ducks around here. We take some time to learn about edible wild plants, where the mushrooms and the berries grow and all that. You'll need some energy in case the power grid goes splat. I have about 100 pounds of propane in various tanks, plus about a month's worth of wood out on our patio. There are boxes of candles in our pantry, plus some LED headlights and some wind-up flashlights. We're also blessed with a 50-watt solar panel and two deep discharge batteries. I figure we could hang in for 3 months without power, but we still need some heavy insulated drapes to survive with just a fireplace in the winter months. We have lived that way before. It's tough, but not necessarily unpleasant. Please pay attention to this idea of a pulse economy. That means instead of regular services like water, electricity, food on demand, the new economy is more likely to come in waves. The power may be available for a few hours a day, like in most of the underdeveloped world. Food in particular naturally comes in waves along with nature's seasons. It makes total sense to buy lots of potatoes when they are cheap in October and store them in a cool but not frozen place where they can last at least until the following March. We did this year in our condo with a basement and noticed that the price of potatoes doubled by January. Money saved and potato security. You will learn when the rhubarb comes in, the asparagus, the green beans, and buy them by the bushel from farmers or at farmers' markets. Then pressure can them into glass sealer jars for the coming year. The same comes later in the summer for the fruits, which just need a dehydrator or a simple boiling water canner. Remember, you must have a pressure canner to preserve most vegetables, and certainly for cooked meals like stews and all meats. Home canned goods do not depend on freezer space or electricity at all. Many of these things are already cooked for you, so you have food to heat up over a fire if the gas or electricity goes out. Note that the power just came on in Arkansas this week, a full month after a freak ice storm in late January. That can happen anywhere, as it did in Quebec, Canada a few years ago. Ditto hurricanes and earthquakes. Well, not to speak of the global flu pandemic. I don't know whether that's ever going to happen. So you learn to harvest food when it comes. I expect industrial production will be the same way. Right now, the stores and the sales lots are full of excess goods that consumers are afraid or too broke to buy. That production will be sold off at sale prices. And that's the end of that consumer dream. The shippers who take raw materials to Chinese factories are parking their big freighters or going bankrupt. The factories are shutting down all over the world, including in North America, as demand slumps. It may be a decade before they start up again, if ever. I predict that things like socks and cooking pots will appear sporadically in the remaining outlet stores, exactly like life in the former Soviet Union. When things appear, you buy them if you can, adapting to the pulse of the economy and of the goods. You may end up bartering a lot of the time. We don't know what's going to happen to the value of our money. Speaking of comparisons to the Soviet Union, I highly recommend Dmitry Orlov's tips for surviving hard times at cluborlov.blogspot.com. I also recommend his book, Reinventing Collapse, Soviet Example and American Prospects. It's very useful reading for those shocked to find themselves in the new depression. And he has free audio MP3s of his talks at that same blog. Also check out my Radio EcoShock interview with Dmitry Orlov at our website, ecoshock.org. That's in the show for May 30th, 2008, in our archive. We were way ahead of the time on that one. Here's a quick sample from that show, starting with a quote from Dmitry Orlov. In reflecting the process by which society as a whole, or at least the informed and thinking parts of it, is reconciling itself to the inevitability of a discontinuous future, with our institutions and life support systems undermined by a combination of resource depletion, catastrophic climate change, and political impotence. Well, here are the five stages.
Stage 1.
Financial collapse. Faith in business as usual is lost. The future is no longer assumed to resemble the past in any way that allows risk to be assessed, and financial assets to be guaranteed. Financial institutions become insolvent. Savings are wiped out, and access to capital is lost.
Stage 2.
Commercial collapse. Faith that the market shall provide is lost. Money is devalued and/or becomes scarce. Commodities are hoarded. Import and retail chains break down, and widespread shortages of survival necessities become the norm.
Stage 3.
Political collapse. Faith that the government will take care of you is lost. As official attempts to mitigate widespread loss of access to commercial sources of survival necessities fail to make a difference, the political establishment loses legitimacy and relevance.
Stage 4.
Social collapse. Faith that your people will take care of you is lost, as local social institutions, be they charities or other groups that rush in to fill the power vacuum, run out of resources, or fail through internal conflict.
Stage 5.
Cultural collapse. Faith in the goodness of humanity is lost. People lose their capacity for kindness, generosity, consideration, affection, honesty, hospitality, compassion, and charity. That's a quote from Turnbull, the mountain people. Families disband and compete as individuals for scarce resources. The new motto becomes, may you die today so that I die tomorrow. That's from Solzhenitsyn, the Gulag Archipelago. There may even be some cannibalism, end quote from Dmitry Orlov. Now, Orlov doesn't predict cannibalism as a future for America. He just says some societies have reached terrible stages, and he gives examples in his book from the dislocated African tribe described in another book, The Mountain People, by Colin M. Turnbull. Hopefully, by learning from previous cases of collapse, we can learn how to do better as individuals and as a society. But we shouldn't wait until things drop down to the bottom, to the pit of collapse. Find out more about Dmitry Orlov at cluborlov.blogspot.com. I'm Alex Smith, and we've been covering ideas to enhance your survival right where you are. But in the longer term, is it really time to look for a better place to live? How friendly will your city be when the riots hit? How defensible is your little hideaway in town? Will rising seas overwhelm your real estate? What about wildfires driven by killer heat waves? Maybe you were ready for eco-migration. It came out recently that Baron Nicholas Stern, former chief World Bank economist and author of the British Stern Report, expects mass refugees due to climate change. Charles Hanley of the Associated Press said that without significant carbon controls, Stern expects climate change to, quote, transform where people can live. People would move on a massive scale. Hundreds of millions, probably billions of people would have to move if you talk about 4, 5, 6 degree increases. Stern is talking about 7 to 10 degree Fahrenheit and likely local, if not global, wars because, quote, there's no way the world can handle that kind of population move in the time period in which it would take place, end quote. Most of the billions who will be forced to move are in Asia, Africa, and Latin America. They will go toward the cooler areas and the water. That means either the remaining wet tropics, but more likely, like the birds and the fish, toward the poles. Welcome to Siberia, Scandinavia, New Zealand, or Canada, the new, most populous countries in a climate-damaged world. We are honored to have one of the world's top experts on eco-migration with us on Radio EcoShock. Dr. Norman Myers is currently a professor at Green College, Oxford, and a visiting professor at many other prestigious universities. He has advised world leaders, published 19 books, and is known for pioneering research into new problems. He is one of only two persons worldwide to receive all three leading environmental prizes from UNEP, plus the Volvo Environment and Blue Planet prizes. Dr. Myers, welcome.
Thank you. Very glad to be with you.
Can we start with a short explanation of what eco-migration is?
Yes, it's a term that has come into fairly widespread use in the last few years. After I defined eco-migration in 1993 as referring to those people who, here we go, find themselves obliged to leave their long-time residence area for reasons largely environmental, but also including additional factors such as poverty, population pressures, and so on. These people leave their usual habitats because they feel compelled to do so. They do not move at all out of choice. So they are quite unlike the economic opportunists who number maybe 200 million, whereas the environmental refugees, environmental migrants, as I call them, total only, well, less than 50 million. Does that respond to your question?
It does indeed, and I want to ask you, is climate disruption becoming a bigger driver of eco-migration versus simple pollution, say, or things like overgrazing?
Oh, yes, yes. Overgrazing, desertification, deforestation, water shortages, things of that sort, have been quite a significant problem. You see, if there are 50 million of these people, that's, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, I think that's twice as many people as you have in the whole of Canada. So it's a pretty big phenomenon, and that in itself is growing quite rapidly. But climate refugees, a kind of subset of environmental refugees, will, according to some calculations I did half a dozen years ago, leave us with the prospect of maybe about 220 million people could, and according to the IPCC, could surge to as many as half a billion people by 2050 or so. This is a much, much larger environmental problem than we've seen so far. But don't let me altogether downside. This is not only a problem, but it is also a massive opportunity. We still have time, though only just enough time, to do a great deal to reduce the unprecedented damage that climate change will otherwise cause.
Where are the biggest eco-migrations happening so far?
Within the compass of sub-Saharan Africa, there's a lot there, and a lot have been threatened or overtaken by storm surges in coastal zones, hurricanes. And that applies especially in the Bay of Bengal, the Nile Delta, the eastern coastal areas of both China and India. Also quite a lot in, you see, there's quite a big migration from Mexico into the United States. And some of these people, only some, but a significant proportion of these people, are driven by environmental factors as opposed to economic opportunity.
Well, surely big think tanks and the world military are looking closely at eco-migration as one of the great problems of the century. Is this a growing field of research, and what tools can we apply to find out more?
It is a growing field. Thank goodness at last, at long last. I mentioned earlier that my original report was dated 1993, and for the first 10 years, the amount of action that we saw from governments and international agencies was, and I choose my word carefully, virtually nil. For various reasons of institutional inertia, political inclination to look the other way, a good deal of ignorance, if not ignorance, on the part of big business.
Well, the question is, what tools can we use to find out more about this now that we've identified it?
I think the main response to try to counter this massive phenomenon of environmental refugees is to address the causes of the migration. Hitherto, we've tended to address the symptoms of the problem, and we should go to the sources of the problem and ask ourselves, why do these people feel so driven to migrate in the first place, and what can we do to relieve that compulsive pressure? And that means that we must phase out the motivation that these people have to migrate, and in turn, that means pursuing what is known in the trade as sustainable development. We must enable these people to enjoy lifestyles that are acceptable, sustainable, and that means looking at water supplies, in particular in various parts of the world, tackling soil erosion, grand-scale pollution of various sorts, problems of that sort. Now, we know what to do. We have enough science and technological research. We know what to do, and we have the technologies to do the necessary. And we've found by experience that it will not cost the Earth to save the Earth. On the contrary, it will often put money into our pockets. But what we need, the resource in shorter supply right now, is not money or scientific understanding. It is political leadership, of which there is a woeful dearth.
Well, what should we be doing? I mean, for example, I've heard some people say in Britain, perhaps Britain should be setting up a stronger hospital system and prepared for more schools, because people will be coming from North Africa and various places where the deserts are expanding or drying out, and Britain and Scandinavia may have to pick up some of the load.
We should certainly be doing that on purely humanitarian grounds, but in terms of trying to get on top of this problem before it gets on top of us, that those measures you've mentioned won't go very far at all. This is not, repeat, not to decry those efforts, but in terms of reducing the overall problem, they won't go very far at all. We're already sorely late. If we got on with the job 10 or 15 years ago, we could have done a lot to relieve the plight of these migrants, but as it is, we've got a heck of a task on now because there's so much climate change in the pipeline.
I'd like to pick your mind for a second about China. I've been told that there are about 400 million people in the north of China experiencing a severe drought, while in the south, extreme storms have damaged some of the crops. I'm wondering, could we picture a world in which the Chinese move north into Siberia if the climate does shift, if we can't get things under control?
Oh, wow. That's a real big one, because I don't suppose the Russians would stand by idly and watch millions of Chinese cross the border. That's why this issue is being addressed by military agencies, security agencies. But you're quite right. The northern half of China, where one third of the grain crop of the wheat crop is grown, is very short of water, and it's getting a lot shorter. In the southern half of China, there's in some places a surplus of water, and that's why the Chinese are investing huge amounts of money to build great pipelines from the Yangtze River into the northern sector. But again, that is tackling symptoms of the problem and not getting at the source of the problem. We should ask, well, why has this problem arisen in the first place? Why wasn't it tackled earlier? What are the political roadblocks that have prevented action thus far? The questions you're raising are very excellent questions in my view, and I'm wondering if I'm giving answers that are sufficiently substantive and pointed and on target.
Oh, I think so. You're one of the preeminent experts in this field. You know, I'm thinking too about people in Australia are more aware of this problem because of the South Sea Islanders are already planning their move as rising seas will displace some of their countries. But here in North America, we really don't hear about eco-refugees. It's just not a topic of discussion. And I'm wondering, why should North Americans tune into this problem?
Well, I think they should stick around and stay tuned, frankly. The agricultural basis of North America's security, stability, prosperity, and so on is under quite severe threat in a globally warmed world. There'll be lots and lots of people flooding into the United States from Mexico and the Caribbean and other parts of Latin America. And to think that this tidal wave of migrants can be held back by building a big fence along the southern border of the United States, it helps, but that's all. And what has been a trickle has become somewhat of a stream. The stream will become a flood. And the flood will, according to the IPCC, and that is within a decade or so, become a torrent.
Yes, I can remember back in grade school learning Latin, and one of the things that we learned was about how the Roman guards were absolutely unable to stop the German masses, hundreds of thousands of people coming with all their possessions, just coming through every forest and stream there was. You really can't build a fence against that sort of event.
No, you certainly can't, just as you can't launch fighter planes against advancing desert. Let me just mention very briefly, if I can compress the point, that the way you said about Chinese flooding into Russia. There was a day when Russia and China went to war, and after the first day, the Russians had taken 1 million prisoners and said, do you want to give up? The Chinese said no. By the third day, the Russians had taken 5 million prisoners and said to the Chinese, do you want to give up? And the Chinese said, no. Do you want to give up?
Oh, dear. Well, as we wrap up, are there any parting points that you'd like to make, or perhaps even a website or an institution that listeners who want to follow up more could go to?
Well, the IPCC, that's the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, has a great deal of detail on the mechanisms of climate change, what is causing it, how far it's gone already, how far is momentum already built into the system that we must look at. But above all, we must do much, much more to acknowledge that this is a major problem, quite unprecedented since we came out of our caves, unprecedented in scale and size and character. It's going to be one of the biggest shocks, or rather, let's be a bit positive and say one of the biggest challenges that humankind has ever had to tackle in the past. And it may finally help us to acknowledge that we do really live on a single planet, and we must try to make room for all inhabitants, no matter where they might be or where they've come from.
Dr. Norman Myers, thank you so much for your time. Currently a professor at Oxford, that was one of the world's top experts on environmental problems, and possibly the founder of the study of eco-migration. What a gift that scientists are so generous with their time. Check out the article by Dankar Vedantam in the Washington Post, February 23rd. The title is, Climate Fears Are Driving Eco-Migration Across the Globe. In the story, an American couple from Montgomery County decide to move to New Zealand, hoping to provide a safer climate for their two children. Many more of our American listeners will decide to move north to Canada. It's pretty easy. Perhaps we'll do a show on what that means, the hoops you have to jump for immigration. But in the longer run, I expect an unstoppable march in migration from the United States north following the rain, looking for cooler temperatures and places where crops will still grow, the new northern temperate zones. While all the world can see the climate shifting, we still have lots of congressmen and senators left over who just don't get it. Listen to this Texas congressman at last week's hearings of the Subcommittee on Energy and the Environment.
The chair recognizes the ranking member of the full committee, the gentleman from Texas.
I am, I don't think it's a surprise, a skeptic that mankind is causing the climate to change. I do agree that the climate is changing. That's self-evident. I just have a problem because I'm a registered professional engineer. When I look at all the evidence of the past climate change cycles to see what's different about this one, that somehow mankind is the cause. We understand that global warming is a theory, and it may even be a practical theory, but I'm not yet ready to accept that it's a theology. And some of the more fervent global warming advocates do take it as a theology or pseudo-religion. When you try to debate with them the facts of the case, they get very intensely upset.
I don't know how Chairman Ed Markey, who really does get it, how he can sit there so patiently listening to the flat earthers say that our huge industrial exhaust has nothing to do with climate change. I guess there's still lots of oil and coal lobby money for campaign funds for these deniers. At least the Texans have stopped denying climate change exists, perhaps after Hurricane Ike and Galveston. Worse, I keep finding comments from the right-wing bloggers saying, oh, well, there's always been climate change. Nothing we can do. Yes, there have been hothouse worlds which developed over long time periods, millions of years, not a couple of hundred years, and everybody larger than a mouse died. Or how about this spiritual cable TV host who thinks that the earth just wants to be warm?
The earth is in a cycle as a great being herself.
Yes.
We humans are really an extension of the earth. So I don't think we're doing anything that the earth itself doesn't want done. So maybe we're supposed to raise the temperatures and the earth will go through its next phase. Maybe we're assisting that level of consciousness of what the earth is. So what I really want to talk about is this consciousness of earth as a Gaia, as a being, and how does that fit into what people say is global warming and consciousness.
Yeah, the seasons we knew were just tired. Earth was ready for a change. Our stupidity of hauling out millions of years of concentrated solar energy to drive to the Dairy Queen is Gaia's will. That's when I need to practice my belly breathing. It's a technique I picked up recently to focus on the body's breath and release stress. We'll all need something to keep our cool while everyone around us is losing theirs.
Let's wind up the troops.
You are about to embark upon the great crusade toward which we have striven these many months.
Oh, what fun and adventure we have ahead of us. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Go ahead and steal a bunch of MP3s from our free website at ecoshock.org. Load up your iPod, computer, or CD player and get ready, because the change is upon us. In this program, you have heard song clips from reggae master Jimmy Cliff, The Harder They Come, Mark Knopfler and Emmylou Harris, and Canadian artist Shane Phillips, See You in the Sun. Check out YouTube for that version of The Monster Crash with lyrics by Martin Iger and the comedy bit Greensumption from Nuganix.com. We'll go out with another Canadian, Leonard Cohen's Closing Time.
Saddles with acid and the holy spirits crying, where's the beef? And the moon is swimming naked and the summer night is fragrant with a mighty expectation of relief. So we struggle and we stagger down the snakes and up the ladder to the tower where the blessed hours chime. And I swear it happened just like this, a sigh, a cry, a hungry kiss. The gates of love, they buzz and inch. I can't say much has happened since the closing time.
Closing time.
I swear it happened just like this, a sigh, a cry, a hungry kiss. The gates of love, they buzz and inch. I can't say much has happened since. Closing time. I loved you for your beauty, but that doesn't make a fool of me. You were in it for your beauty too. And I loved you for your body. There's a voice that sounds like God to me, declaring. Sorrow and a sense of overtime. And I missed you since a place got wrecked. And I just don't care what happens next. Looks like freedom, but it feels like death. It's something in between. I guess it's closing time. Yeah, I missed you since our place got wrecked by the winds of change and the weeds of sex. And it looks like freedom, but it feels like death. It's something in between, I guess. Yeah, we're drinking and we're dancing, but there's nothing really happening, and the place is dead as heaven on a Saturday night. And my very close companion gets me fumbling, gets me laughing. She's 100, but she's wearing something tight. And I lift my glass to the awful truth, which can't reveal to the ears of you, except to say it isn't worth a damn. And
And the whole damn place goes crazy twice. And it's once for the devil and it's once for Christ. By the boss thrown like these dizzy heights. We're busted in the blinding lights of closing time. The whole damn place goes crazy twice. And it's once for the devil and it's once for Christ. But the boss don't like these dizzy heights. We're busted in the blinding lights. Closing time. Oh, women tear the blouses off, and the men they dance on the polka dots. It's closing time.